Every organization today is sitting on a mountain of personal data. The question is no longer whether to protect it. Popia made that non-negotiable. The real question is, how do you build a data strategy that is both innovative and responsible? My guest today has answered that question practically and at scale across telematics, telecommunications, and financial services. She began her career as an attorney before building some of Africa's most consequential data privacy functions from the ground up. She has led data privacy at MIX Telematics, MTN, and APSA Group, and today serves as group head of data privacy at a leading South African financial services group. She was recently named one of South Africa's 100 cyber leaders to watch for 2026, a recognition she received with characteristic humility and a belief that, and I quote, "The future of technology is exciting and it's happening now." Today, we're getting into privacy by design, the gap between regulation and reality, and what it actually takes to make privacy a driver of business value, not just a line item in your risk register. Amanda, welcome to Let's Talk Data. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Lebo. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You have built data privacy functions from scratch at three different types of organizations: telematics, telco, and banking. What did that journey teach you about what privacy really is beyond the legal definition?
So I think one thing that you can never tire of when it comes to privacy is constantly learning, right? You mentioning completely different organizations in type of products that they have, the types of services that they provide, different cultures altogether. So with privacy, you're coming in with one piece, and oftentimes all of the organizations referring to are multinational, so they're multi-jurisdictional in respect of their operations. You're coming into an environment with pieces of legislation that speak to a particular area that need to be applied practically to that particular organization's offering. So, I mean, I remember when I joined MTN, for example, it's a telco. And essentially how the telco makes its money is through data. You know, they sell data, but not the type of data that we're referring to around personally identifiable data. So the very nature of their operations means they are constantly utilizing your personal information in order to provide you a service. And then privacy coming after the fact now says, we've got a certain way that we operate. We've got a certain way that we do things. And here comes this law that almost retrospectively requires us to change the way that we operate. And that was the same in respect of all of those organizations, right? A technology company who is built on essentially surveying where cars are moving, surveying if there's giving you security, like fleet management. So Mixed Telematics dealt with fleet management as one of their offerings, and they are car tracker. So essentially the business offering, they are spies, if I can call it that, right? Because they must make sure that in order for them to be able to protect you and your assets, they know exactly where you are at any given time. They also track your behavior so that they can see if something is outside of the norm and so far as what's happening with your location and any activity in so far as your assets are concerned. And then you've got banking. I mean, how intrusive can we get in so far as our personal information? Banking, which looks at the most sensitive part of you, which is your money, and how to make sure that your money is also protected, taken care of, etc. How do you then make sure that you do all of that, all of these different offerings, within the guardrails of also still ensuring you have autonomy over your own data? So that's, I guess, what it's taught me to understand different industries, to find ways of making it work for different industries, and to also make sure that it's practical. It's not a chock-a-block. It's not something that is actually restricting how organizations work, but it's actually empowering how they provide their services and products.
You know, you've almost described privacy as a trust asset. Can trust actually be measured? And if so, how does a bank know when it's losing it before a breach or a headline tells them?
So that's exactly what privacy is, right? It's a trust asset. And that's how it's evolving, or it's actually not evolving like that. It's always been like that. But that's how our understanding of what privacy is evolving. I think in the past or in recent years, and we can say recent, depends on the type of organization, right? Some are only now waking up to the realities of ensuring that they adhere to regulatory requirements around privacy. Some have had programs from 2015, 2016 on privacy. And what we are now understanding is that you cannot have customers without trust, because customers don't stay where they don't feel they can trust you with their information. And essentially, it's information that they give you in order for you to provide them with a service. So I think organizations are evolving in their understanding of privacy to understand that it is about building trust. I think most of the strategies that I've seen for some of the banks that I've worked for is they are premised on building trust. One of them, the compliance strategy, the slogan was actually, "We build trust." And you cannot build trust if you're not protecting the personal information, special personal information of your customers, amongst other ways that you can actually build or trust. You talk about incidents. Incidents have always been in our environments, right? Incidents, cybersecurity incidents, for one, which was the type of incidents that were properly understood, well-resourced to test against, protect the banks against, telcos against, to prepare for. In cybersecurity, we say you can never be cyber secure. You can only be cyber prepared, because there's always someone, there's syndicates of organizations, businesses who work with trying to penetrate your environment. I remember the one organization a day, and it's not any of the banks, was having attempted penetrations, I think 358 a day, attempted penetrations that they were picking up a day. That alone just tells you how volatile the environment is when you are a large organization that's providing certain types of services. So incidents were always there. What privacy or privacy legislation then introduced is how you're expected by regulators to actually attend to an incident or respond and react to an incident. I'm talking about 358 incidents that happen in a day, cybersecurity incidents. There were no requirements that you report those incidents to those data subjects or customers or clients whose information was affected or potentially affected by those attempts. Some successful attempts, some unsuccessful attempts. Now we do have the Cybersecurity Act that does govern that. But back then, it was just a matter of the business ensuring that they mitigate whatever potential repercussions came with those attacks, and they put controls in place to make sure there's no reoccurrence. Now, there's a certain amount of time within which you need to ensure you understand what the incident is. There's certain controls that you're expected to put in place to contain an incident. And while you are doing that and trying to also make sure that your environment is stable, it's not destabilized by a particular incident occurring, you're also required to report both to a regulator and to a customer. Now, what happens when you report to a regulator? It will probably sit in their portal for some time. At some point, they'll attend to it, they'll understand what has happened, and then they'll come back to you. But when you report to a customer, that's a different story, right? If you send me a message and you say, your information was contained or affected by a data breach, and it's in a bank, what information are you thinking about? You're not thinking about your name. You're thinking about your money. That's the only thing you're thinking about, right? So that then also creates a very different reaction and response, which you also need to cater to attend to, because now you've got customer complaints, customer inquiries. You've got other would-be fraudsters who are making attempts around that. So you need to make sure that your controls are in place and your flags are in place in the fraud environment. So it's created quite a disturbance, if I can call it that, to the business as usual of doing business for organizations because of some of these requirements that might actually seem very overbearing for organizations. But they are to ensure that in the world of information, your information still belongs to you. And organizations you entrust with this information are actually making sure they take you along the journey and are transparent around what's happening with it.
So you started as an attorney. At what point did you realize that the law alone couldn't do the job, that you needed to be inside the business and not just advising it?
It wasn't really me thinking like that in the way that you phrased your question. I would actually say privacy has always wanted me as opposed to me wanting privacy, because one, I've always been a Big Brother is watching conspiracy theorists before some of the things that have actually translated into reality that we are seeing now translated, right? And I've always been a very private person in that sense. And I've always been very suspicious of whether it's an organization or even a person in a conversation who's constantly wanting too much information and asking too many questions around personal stuff. So because of the nature of the person, when this particular piece of legislation came out, it was almost automatic that this would be an area that one would actually do well in. So I firstly never wanted to leave litigation. I loved litigation. I've always loved debating, arguing, winning arguments more than anything else. And moving out of practice was actually supposed to be temporary. So I had moved from Durban, where I was running my own practice, and moved to Joburg. But to run a practice, you need to have a very good network, right? So that the network gives you business. And that's how you keep the practice afloat. And I didn't have that here in Joburg. So strategically, I thought, let me go into corporate. I'll have secure income. I'll be able to use the skill sets that I have from my legal background while I build a network so that I can go back into practice. Well, obviously, I'm sitting here with you this afternoon. That didn't happen. And then privacy happened to me, right? So the first organization I joined was, back then it was called JD Group. And it was a retail company. It's still around, but now it's sitting under, I think, Pepco Holdings. So it's the guys that had your, I almost said Ellerines, exposing my age, but it's the guys that had your Joshua Dawes, your Incredible Connections, Hi-Fi Corp, etc. Those were the businesses that holding company was owned. And when I joined, my predecessor had been running their Poppy program at that stage. Everyone was calling it Poppy. I hope you didn't call it Poppy, Lebo, because the information regulator has been very strict around saying it's Poppia. So they had a Poppy program that they had just started at the time. And when I got the handover in respect of what I would be responsible for, lo and behold, Poppy. I knew about it from practice. I knew I had read it. I had actually given also input because I was just like that when it was still circulating for comments, etc. But to be honest with you, I didn't know it would be as big as it is now. Not poppy, but privacy, right? And my mentor at the time said to me, because I joined in compliance, said to me, you know, there's a lot of compliance officers. There's a lot of people that are doing compliance. You need to find your niche. And at the time, I was doing AML, which is anti-money laundering. I was doing fin crime, financial crime. I was doing this poppy project as one of those things. And I was looking at other things within the compliance space. So it was a very broad portfolio that I had. And after I had that conversation with him, and he was saying, this is going to be very big, I then started to focus more on Popeye. Right. And it's from there that it just grew larger and larger. I think the president hadn't even signed it into law at the time, because the law was enacted in 2012, but it wasn't in effect, until 2020. And from there, I just started getting headhunted for Poppy. So I've moved from organization to organization for Popeye. And because a lot of organizations hadn't built the infrastructure to support compliance with this legislation, I then became the person who built those that function from the ground up. Actually, one of the organizations, when I joined them, they didn't even have a compliance function. So I had to build a compliance function with the looming at that time, the GDPR was coming into being, and that organization operated in 120 countries. So we had to make sure that in the regional offices, they at least had compliance and privacy officers and officers who are trained on the legislation in their particular country to be able to support the business on compliance. So that's just how then my career has been built up in this area. I'll do this here just when I'm done here and I'm now relaxing. I've built the house. It's got the furniture. I can now enjoy it. Someone else will come knocking and say, look, we need you to come and do something. And you get the answer. We need you to build the house. So I've been operating like that for some time. With the banking financial institutions, it's a bit different. Banks are highly regulated. And they already built functions, had the resources, etc., around these things. But where the issues in some of them was, is it was a volunteer function. Like, oh, okay, there's this Poppy project. Okay, I'll do it. And that's how the resources came to being on privacy. It wasn't necessarily people that were experts in the field that knew exactly what needed to be done and how that were doing it, but it was people that were learning on the job. And that's where I found opportunity to help build expertise, help strategize, help transform privacy programs.
So you moved from advising organizations on the law to actually building the functions inside them. At MIX Mixed Telematics, you did that globally, GDPR and Poppeye simultaneously from scratch. What does building from scratch actually mean? Where do you even start?
Where you actually start is understanding the organization, right? What am I working with here? And secondly, understanding what the organization is trying to achieve. So what is the strategy of this organization holistically? Because whether there's a piece of legislation or not, it's the strategy that's the focal point of that particular organization. And the law needs to be applied, but in a way that makes sense to that particular organization. You don't take a piece of legislation and copy and paste it into the environment of that organization. You look at how do we operate, what do we do, and what does this law mean for us? And that is where the expertise is required. So firstly, you understand what am I dealing with? What type of organization am I dealing with? And then secondly, who do I need to talk to make sure that this actually gets the type of attention and buy-in that it requires? Because with anything, I don't know how many laws there are in this country alone. yes, we all want to be good corporate citizens and do the right thing the right way, but we can't adhere to everything all the time. So bottom line is you then need to become an influencer, right? You need to be able to influence leadership, to influence the executives in an organization around the importance of whatever particular piece of legislation. In this instance, I don't need to speak philosophically. You need to influence them and make them understand why privacy is actually important. And why not getting it right will actually affect the bottom line. Because if it doesn't affect the bottom line, then there's no need for us to put any focus or attention on it. But if it will affect the bottom line, then it matters. And I think everyone is quickly learning that it actually does affect the bottom line and it does matter. So it was much harder back then to do the convincing. You had to do a lot of rallying. It's become easier because privacy has almost made a name for itself around its importance and why data is actually an asset. And because it's an asset, the privacy of it and how you handle it is also something that's quite paramount. So it's speaking for itself now. But back then, you had to also do a lot of rallying, influencing. Then once you've done that and you've got the buy-in, and you understand the organization, then you look at the piece of legislation, you look at the laws that are relevant in your particular environment. If you've only been exposed to South African markets, you will think of Papier. But if you look at how many countries we have in Africa alone, you'll be surprised at how many pieces of privacy legislations we actually have in most of those countries in Africa alone. Let's not even go into the European, Asian, and now America has come to the party as well around privacy legislation. So you then learn that this is not a piece of legislation. It's a world of legislations. Some integrate into privacy. They're not necessarily national laws, but they've got obligations that are privacy related, sitting in other laws. You need to understand that holistically. You as an individual will not know everything. Okay, it's impossible. But you need to know where to source information. You need to also be able to understand whether the information that you have sourced is accurate. And then once that happens, and you've made sense of that, of all of that, those legislations, what of that legislation applies to your organization? So you do almost like a risk assessments, right? What are the risks associated with this piece of legislation in this organization? And then what type of controls do we need to put in place to ensure that we adhere with the requirements of the legislation? Then who are the role players? You know, who is my army, essentially, that I'm going to be battling this with? That you also need to be clear about. And then your army needs to also understand who they are and what role they play insofar as ensuring that this trust that we are trying to build is actually built even in their environment and sustainably so. So that's essentially, I would say, the journey. And then throughout all of that, you are still influencing. You are influencing. You are convincing, you are convincing, and you are educating, and you educate again and again. And while you educate yourself because you see privacy is a constitutional right in its origins, but it's now given birth to a lot of brothers and sisters that also require that this right is exercised in them, like your AI. Like your data sharing practices, other technology advancements, etc. So it's the gift that keeps giving, and you must constantly be learning while doing everything else in the building.
You said the hardest part was changing how people think. What is the conversation that actually works, the one that shifts a developer's instinct about data without making them feel policed?
Oh, you mean a developer? You're talking about engineers and architects?
Yes.
You mean? So And that's a different type of breed altogether, right? Because if you are an engineer, you are trying to build something for a particular purpose. So privacy is not the first thing that comes to mind. The first thing that comes to mind is, how do I build something that works? And how do I make sure that it's not going to break down, etc. High level example. When we started, outside of convincing developers, because I think with developers, it's lesser convincing, more, look, guys, this has been approved, go and do. It's the execution part, right? More than the being convinced of what needs to be executed part. But just on a different type of answer to your question, back in the day, so the earlier years of privacy, it was just the stick, right? You use the stick. Look, if we don't do this, if we don't do this right, we're going to get fined, we're going to get penalties, we're going to get regulatory scrutiny, we're going to have reputational risk, our customers are going to leave us, etc. It was the stick. And it worked to a large degree, actually. But right now, it doesn't sell. Now, it's educating people, right? So if you're talking to a data architect, you're talking to a data scientist, you're talking to a data engineer, it's educating them around the how, practically, because they don't want to hear your philosophical speak around why privacy is important. They're not so much interested in that. They're interested in, okay, you know what I need to do. What does your privacy requirements have to do with what I need to do? So it's practically breaking down, which also means you need to understand what they do, right? It's practically breaking down what they need to put in place or not put in place, consider or not consider when they are building, let's say, a system or a solution or a model of sorts. For example, things like, you touched on it earlier, privacy by design. Most organizations, especially the older ones, they already have systems that they've been using for however many years. They already have solutions, you know, that they trust. Third-party service providers that they trust to provide a particular solution or a service. So now saying retrospectively, the system is not private by design. It becomes a bit of a tall ask, right? Especially if it's a third-party service provider, because depending on how big that service provider is, they might say, look, take it or leave it. You know, we're not going to change anything in respect of our system. We're not going to change anything in respect of our offering. So-and-so is utilizing it. They don't have a problem. You know, you take it, you leave it. Very seldom do you have, especially the bigger organizations that provide services to institutions, saying, oh, okay, we're going to go and change our system. We're going to go and change our policies. We're going to go and put certain security protocols to adhere to your privacy requirements. That seldom happens. So that's a whole different conversation on its own. But internally, it becomes easier when it's a new system that's coming into the environment, because there you've got the opportunity to build in privacy requirements at the onset. So that's what we term privacy by design, right? So you can put in requirements like data minimization, for example, where, yes, the system that you're building could probably can scan through an environment, for example, and collect tons of data. But what data do you actually need for the system to actually be effective? If you don't need ID numbers, for example, can we then make sure that in the data that you collect, you've got controls in place that pick up ID numbers and they either delete or don't actually even consume that type of data altogether? So whatever it may be, whatever example it may be, essentially What is the minimum type of data that you need to put in place? That sounds practical to a data engineer, as opposed to you saying, well, there's privacy legislation that we need to adhere to, so make sure your system is private. What are you talking about? Right. You know, things like making sure that if it's something that's on the cloud, data is actually secure in transit and at rest. And in transit, you've put in specific, whether it's encryptions, hashing, you know, tokenization, whatever you put in place to make sure that as this data travels from one place to another, it's actually secure. That's privacy by design. I can give you multiple examples, but essentially for the language of a developer, the language of a data engineer, data architect, scientist, etc., solution builders, that's the type of language you need to speak with them.
You mentioned Popia created a kind of urgency that internal advocates haven't been able to create on their own. It came into full effect in 2021. You were at MTN when it landed, then moved to APSA shortly after. What actually changed inside organizations, not on paper, but in behavior and decision making?
So I'd say the conversation changed a bit, because I think by the time 2020 hit, when the president signed the legislation, right, which then triggered the 12-month period to make sure that you are compliant with it, it had just been a song, you know, that is being sung, that, the act is going to come into effect, the act is going to come into effect. For those who are further from Popia specifically, and what was happening in that environment, yes, it might have looked like that. For us who were closer to what was happening in the background, we could actually anticipate that any day now, a date, insofar as effective enactment of the legislation, because we saw the regulator post being advertised. We saw Advocate Bansi being appointed. We saw her then appointing members and building up the offices. We saw them finding office space. So obviously that tells us that these people are actually preparing. But if you're far from it, you wouldn't have recognized or known that something like that means that this is actually imminent. So when 2020 then hit, I think it was June 2020 when it was announced that it's been signed and it's now that you've got 12 months to be fully compliant. Organizations that hadn't run any programs then tried to scrape, right, to run those programs. I think APSA at the time had already run their privacy program, that already closed it out and handed it over to business. They already had a privacy office that was established. They had resources that were specifically dedicated to data privacy. And they were operating as though the legislation was fully effective already. Right? Yes, with some improvements here and there, like any other organization had at the time. So it wasn't, oh no, the world is coming to an end, so to speak. But what it did mean is that the rooms within which privacy was not being discussed then changed. And I think we found ourselves as privacy experts or professionals now sitting in quite a number of tables, explaining, re-explaining, reminding, re-educating around what are we actually talking about, what needs to be done, and importantly, is what we have sufficient? Are we doing the right thing the right way? Should the regulator come knocking, will we be found on the right side of the table insofar as this conversation is concerned? So that's effectively what it did. It gave us a bit of budget where we didn't have budget to actually manage the privacy offices, etc. So it was positive, still continues to be positive for privacy professionals who might have felt like they were being left out of important conversations, they were being left out of important decisions around the direction of the organization, around the strategy of the organization, and around innovations and products that were going to be launched, etc. It now gave you an invite into the room to and a voice around what the organization is doing.
So if you're honest about it, where are most South African organizations really sitting on POPIA compliance today?
A lot of what I'm going to say is generalizations, right? Because as much as I am a professional in this space, I'm also a consumer of services. But I consume with a different hat, right? Because I understand my rights, if you want to call it that. Organizations are still far from where they need to be. I have found when probing some that they haven't put controls in place to mitigate privacy risks from materializing. But what they've done is try to make sure that they cover up very well what they're not doing right, as opposed to just doing the right thing the right way. I was at the Information Regulators conference earlier in the year, and I was part of conversations around exactly this, you know, what is the maturity of organizations when it comes to data privacy? And they had done some extensive research across the country around how organizations are faring on POPIA compliance in particular. The outcomes of that survey, or those surveys that they did, were so poor and so sad that for the average South African, you should be very worried about the data and the information that is sitting across a lot of the organizations that we trust and that are processing our information. I think what was daunting and scary was that there's a number of organizations that are processing your information that you know nothing about. And that takes away, one, autonomy. It also takes away your ability to control what they do or don't do with the information. And because the regulator is so small, and expected to look at such a large landscape, they can't get to everything, which means they barely get into anything. And what that means for the average South African is that organizations can then get away with this, you know, for as long as they can. Banks, financial institutions can't, because highly regulated, outside of the information regulator, we've got the Prudential Authority, we've got the FISCA, we've got the NCA. There's plenty of regulators whose eyes are, you know, very closely on banks and how we do what we do. So that's a different environment. But everyone else, and especially government departments, it's actually scary. The less you know, the better when it comes to that.
You know, most people use cybersecurity and data protection interchangeably, including people who should know better. When those two things get confused inside a large organization, what actually goes wrong and who ends up paying the price?
So I wouldn't say there's a price to be paid per se. I can contextualize that. There can be cybersecurity without data privacy. There can't be data privacy without cybersecurity. So, as part of the 8 conditions within POPIA, for example, one of the conditions is ensuring that you have organizational and technical security safeguards to secure and protect the data. So, organizational safeguards would be your your policies, your frameworks, etc., that govern security around data, and then the technical would then be the actual controls that you have in place to make sure that data is secure. So that forms part of privacy. So as a privacy professional, a data protection officer, an SME, you need to make sure that you understand fully what the cybersecurity teams, information security teams, IT teams are actually doing insofar as control environments when it comes to data. Where there could be what you are saying, where we could have consequences maybe of getting it wrong, is where cybersecurity professionals are not fully trained around the difference between a cyber incident and a data privacy incident. As an example, a cyber incident or an IT incident, if we can call it that, or an IT event, triggers certain protocols around how you respond, how you react, how you respond, and how you report, right? A data privacy incident triggers very different mechanisms. Yes, the response from a technical perspective might be similar, but there are other requirements that come with privacy, and they are very time sensitive as well. So that's where we can get it wrong, that if you've got cybersecurity professionals who are saying, oh, that was just a cybersecurity incident, but they're not actually able to pick up that, no, there's personally identifiable data that's involved, or information read with other information can identify a particular data subject, then it triggers that reporting. If they don't pick that up, then you can have incidents that are not reported to the regulator, to the data subject, and then you're finding yourself in regulatory breach. So that's just one example where perhaps things could go wrong. But essentially, they work almost hand in hand. But like I said, you can have cybersecurity without data privacy, with limitations naturally. But you definitely can't have data privacy without cybersecurity.
So the cybersecurity officer and the data privacy officer sitting in the same building, sometimes in the same meeting, what does that relationship look like in a well-functioning organization versus one where the confusion you're describing has taken hold?
It looks like you and me are brother and sister, right? We're in the same family. We are related. What affects you affects me. What affects me affects you. So there's open communication between the two. I've got access to your environment, and you've got access to mine. But importantly, the understanding and the knowledge is the knowledge, actually, more than the understanding. The knowledge is consistently shared between the two of us so that our understanding of what we are trying to achieve and how we need to achieve that is the same. What do I mean by that? As a DPO sitting next to, let's say, the head of cybersecurity, I need to know, in respect of your strategy, when you're talking about putting in place certain security protocols, etc., what is that? And what standards are you adhering to? What standards are you looking at to then measure the level at which you are putting the level or the types of controls that you are putting in place? And then are they fit for purpose to ensure that our privacy obligations are also catered for? And on this side, you also need to understand, what is our strategy? Are we looking at bare minimum insofar as the control environment? Is that our expectation from a maturity perspective for data privacy? Or are we looking to be, you know, head above the rest? Are we looking at best practice, best international practice, so that there is a synergy in respect of what you are planning, what you are doing, and what we are trying to achieve from a privacy perspective?
You know, banks are building algorithms that make consequential decisions, credit risk and pricing. Those algorithms are trained on data that carries historical bias. How do you navigate situations where an algorithm is technically compliant but raises ethical concerns?
So in the banks, right, we have what frameworks that speak around the ethical use of data, Although that doesn't speak to squarely data privacy, it speaks to ethics at large, because what you're referring to speaks to ethics, right? It speaks to behaviors that we put in the system in order for us to make determinations and decisions, as opposed to utilizing specific information and ensuring that that information has the type of controls to be private and it's protected. Not to say we don't work together to inform the narrative, but a lot of work. I think because if there's one thing that even someone who doesn't understand how AI works knows about AI is bias. Yeah, AI is biased. How do I know that you're making the right decisions? What informs, you know, your LLMs, etc.? But one thing that I've been exposed to and that I can hand on heart say, when it comes to financial institutions, they've invested and are investing a lot in AI. And the worst that could happen is that your particular model is found wanting in respect of what you wanted to actually achieve, which is to empower you to make decisions. So the ensuring that it doesn't have bias, the testing is done ad nauseum. It's done ad nauseum. And there's always human intervention. I think now because we trust but don't trust LLMs. So there has to then be that human element, which I think we're still fortunate of. And, you know, let's hope it stays like that, that there's always that human intervention, because now they're reinventing their thoughts, they're growing intelligence that was never intended, etc. But when it comes to financial institutions, those types of controls to ensure that there isn't bias, to ensure that the type of information that is actually fed into models has gone through a number of gates before it gets to even non-prod stages, that it will take a long time before something is actually released or it goes live within the banking space. So you can have a certain degree of comfort that every type of protocol that you can think of and thoughts around potential risks associated with an AI has been considered, and the controls have been put in place before it's set to do its thing.
You have had to make the case for privacy investment to executives who see it as a cost. What's the argument that actually moves them? And has that argument changed as AI has entered the picture?
So no, it hasn't. It hasn't. I think what we are finding, what I'm experiencing now, if I compare today to 10 years ago in this field, executives are very informed around data privacy. Leadership of the organizations that I've worked for are quite clued up around the importance of data privacy. And what you're talking about when you say data privacy, you know, they don't think, oh, Poppy, you know, they don't. They understand what are the principles, what are the conditions, what are the consequences, why it's important. Hence why I was saying now you don't need to even use the stick to say you will get fined, you'll get penalized. There's almost an evolved culture around privacy and around understanding why it's important and why the consequences of not actually investing in it is not something that you want to have to pay for as an organization. So the environment has changed insofar as privacy is concerned. But importantly, which is the conversations we are now having or the level at which we are conversing on privacy, there is an understanding on how having your privacy requirements intact and having your ethical requirements when it comes to AI intact can actually give you a competitive advantage in the market. because in an era where organizations are, excuse the word, bastardizing information and people's data, where you stand out as an organization that actually is responsible with data, it attracts customers. And the more trust you're able to build with your customers, the more of a competitive advantage that you have against your peers in the market.
Right. So there's a whole economy built on buying and selling customer data. South African organizations participate in it. Where does that practice sit with Popia, and where does it sit with your own values as a privacy professional?
Yeah. Well, you can't ask where does it sit with my values. I think that's a given. Right. I think where it sits with my values is a given. Hence what I was saying to you earlier. A person who's just going to throw a form that says, oh, these are the terms and conditions, this is a Poppy clause, and think I'm just going to go to the bottom and sign. They hate to see me coming, because one thing I will do, I will read your terms and conditions. I will read your privacy policy. It doesn't take me long to go through all of the data that you have there. I understand the jargon, and I know the fluff. So I think my values and my thinking around that is a given, right? And that's an area that I'm thinking that the regulator is struggling with, because it doesn't happen upfront. It's not obvious. And there's different agreements that are under a certain guise, but essentially they mean organizations are just selling data. It is against the law, if you just put it bluntly, to do that. So anyone who's still doing it is doing that intentionally, knowing what regulatory requirements they are contravening. That is not the environment that I'm in. Right? That is not the environment that I'm in. And where the right type of expertise, the right type of resources are in your institution, they understand ways in which they can monetize data without contravening legislative and regulatory requirements. And there are plenty of those. Data is an asset, like I said earlier. And with an asset, your automatic response is not to take an asset and sell it in order to make money out of it, but it's to find ways for that asset to make you money while being responsible with that asset, because it's just that, an asset. So you don't misuse something that's an asset and still expect it to give forth the results that you intended to give. So it's only those organizations, companies, if I can call it that, that don't necessarily have that moral bone, if you want to call it that, to adhere to regulatory requirements, etc., that you will find still doing or engaging in practices like that. I mean, you might have seen in the paper, in the news yesterday, where the police raided a house that had an entire company house in a nice northern suburb that was operating there, that was fraudulently getting people to close their accounts, and or not to close their accounts, but to open new accounts and to put their money or transfer their money into different accounts. In order for them to be able to actually run those syndicates, they need to purchase that data from somewhere. They need to purchase those books from somewhere. And we found a lot of times that they are being purchased through debt collectors, debt recovery agents, where some of the frameworks around their privacy compliance is not necessarily up to scratch.
There's also a growing phenomenon of shadow AI, employees feeding senses of data into external AI tools outside of formal governance structures. So at a bank where the data is people's most intimate financial information, how real is that risk? And what does responsible AI governance look like when the threat is coming from inside the house?
So the second part of your question will be rendered redundant through my first answer. And it's not me trying to sell how great financial institutions are, because you've seen what's been in the papers in the past week or so with some of our peers. But I can tell you for the financial institution that I'm in now, I am ultimately sitting at the most senior level that you can sit, so far as data privacy is concerned. But some of the controls that we've put in place to ensure that things like that don't happen frustrate even me. Right? So you can barely send anything outside of the banking environment that you do not have permission to send out. The types of controls that information security teams have put in place to ensure that information that's not supposed to be leaving the bank is quickly flagged and then paused. Some instances it's just information that you are sending out practically because you're providing a service. Mm-hmm. But the nature of the controls that have been put in place to prevent that type of activity are so cumbersome that they can even frustrate us who should be celebrating that those controls are in place. So that's the extent to which these activities or behaviors have been curtailed. But I think I've predominantly answered your question, Lebo. And I think, not I think, I know for a fact, right, that because you must remember that we are talking about data protection in the name of customers. So information that belongs to customers that you might be sending where you shouldn't be sending. And, you know, not to say mistakes don't happen, people don't try and curtail the system and whatever controls and protocols have been put in place. You do have those instances. Naturally, you always have malicious actors in your environment, and you can never anticipate where malicious actors might be coming from. But the type of controls that have intentionally been put in place and protocols are designed to curtail that type of behavior. So the point I was getting to is that you're looking at it from a customer lens, but we also look at it from an IP lens, right? So the protection is, yes, to make sure that our customers' information is protected. It's not misused, whether internally or sent out externally where it shouldn't be, but also importantly that company information and company IP is not sent out, misused erroneously. To the extent that in the institution that I work for now, we've developed our own GPT, if you want to call it that, so that internal staff, where they want to make use of AI, they can utilize that, and the guardrails around it is that it's only internal information that goes into that, and you can't take out information from the company and then, for example, put it in ChatGPT, etc. That's actually that's seen as a breach in our environments, because it's unlawful access to information by a system that shouldn't have been accessing that information that's owned by an external company, service provider, which is what ChatGPT, for example, is. So information that sits inside, even by way of email, etc., that type of information is guarded like gold. Like we did say earlier, data is an asset. So that asset, it's in very secure hands. It's not to say, because just now you read in the papers, it's not to say that mistakes don't happen. It's not to say that you don't have would-be malicious actors that go against protocols and find ways to go around the system. That does happen. But by intention, it shouldn't be happening.
So AI literacy and data literacy are mm-hmm. often talked about as separate things. So from a privacy governance perspective, mm-hmm. are they the same mm-hmm. thing? And who in an organization mm-hmm. is responsible for building that literacy at scale?
So it depends on the size of the organization, I think, and the type of organization you would be referring to. A much, much smaller organization that perhaps has one particular product that they offer can't get away with having that type of knowledge set sitting in an individual and one other. They can't get away with, having three people that are catering to that. In the environments that I am in, we've got thousands of resources that look at those different areas. And it's not the same thing. It's definitely not the same thing. Is there a relation between the three? 100%. Are they sometimes integrated? 100%. But the knowledge base or the expertise for AI won't necessarily be found in a privacy professional. The expertise for data governance won't necessarily be found in an AI professional. I was at a talk last week where someone said, anyone who says they're an AI specialist is lying. but it's just not the case. You do have AI specialists now, and you have people that have been in the space for over a decade. The fact that we only came to know of it more popularly in recent years doesn't mean it hasn't always been there in one shape or form, right? Before it was launched in your ChatGPTs, your Claudes, etc. So the literacy of that will again depend on the size of the organization. But I think it is unfair to expect that the expertise for all of those areas will sit in one individual, because it's very different areas with very different mandates even and objectives. Why we have data privacy in place is very different to why you would utilize AI, and very different to what your data governance requirements would be, for example. Because there we're talking about data at large, we're talking about data sovereignty, we're talking about whether it be your managing of records, etc. So it's much broader. And then you'd be talking around AI, where we're talking about models, LLMs, you're talking about building models, you're talking about ensuring that these models are fit for purpose in respect of your particular organization, and all the risks associated with them have actually been understood and mitigated, contained, curtailed, whichever it may be. And then you're talking about privacy, which stems from your right to owning your information or having autonomy over your information as an individual, as an organization in South Africa as well, because Papia also speaks to juristic persons. And there we are talking about ensuring that information is used and processed responsibly. It's different areas. So the literacy would sit in different experts around that. In the States, I was in Washington 2 weeks back. A lot of the organizations I spoke to, I think including Google, they have them sitting under one function. They have privacy, data governance, and AI sitting under one function. It's different resources, but that are sitting under one function, which I think we will probably evolve to that at some point. But right now, looking at the maturity of our organizations, the maturity of those areas in our spaces, we've got a bit of a way to go to make sure that we integrate them.
Before I let you go, you received a recognition recently that I think says a lot about where we are as a sector. The Cyber 100, 100 Cyber Leaders to Watch for 2026. And when you spoke about it, you said something that stayed with me. The future of technology is exciting and it is happening now. I want to end there. What is it that you're most excited about, specifically, not generally? And on the other side of that, what keeps you up at night?
Let me start with the last one, right? You know, I eat the rice first and end with the meat. So what keeps me up at night is that your information is already out there, right? My information is already out there in a way that I can barely control, if I'm honest, right? And sometimes I wonder if the term privacy is not a facade, or a dream, because in all honesty, the amount of information that I intentionally have put out there without understanding what that means, what that could mean in the future, is out there. And there is no way of getting it back. Prince Harry, when he was talking to the importance of data privacy, said, once you lose your privacy, it's gone. He was talking about his personal experiences. And that's what keeps me up at night, right? That we are doing all this work. We are advocates of your privacy is yours. You have the right to privacy. But how much of it can you still actually control? Especially with the introduction of generative AI and whoever his brother and sister is going to be in the near future. Right. And then I think in respect of your first question around what excites me around technology now, it's the opportunities that it brings, right? The opportunities that it's already brought. Someone said that technology's advancements and the way it's advancing now is making us lazy as a people, because we want everything to happen overnight, you know. We want everything now. It's also creating this psychological inability to be patient and to endure, because we're so used to things happening, you know, instantly with the way technology is advancing. I'm of a different view, right? I'm of the view that there are certain aspects in respect of technology. For example, what I as a lawyer would have been spending, 100 hours going through documents in preparation for a trial, now have the opportunity to leverage technology to do the exact same thing, but in record time. That benefits you as a client financially. And it also benefits me because it means I can do more for less time. So if I'm smart about that, it means I can actually take back some of my time to actually enjoy what I work so hard for, instead of constantly just working because I'm chasing time. So I think you said specifically, not in general, that would be an example of instances where I could say, and not in the legal space, but in any space, where your primary function, or even your organization's function, is to constantly be processing information. Technology has afforded us the opportunity to do that, but to do that at the speed of time, and to do that in a more effective way, where we can utilize large, not volumes of information, but also access information from different areas, and make that make sense for us now. Whereas in the good old days, we would have hired an external law firm or an external consultancy company to then bill us 5 million rand to do that for us. You know? So it's providing a lot of opportunities insofar as how we do business, in respect of how my day job goes, where if something is really complicated, I don't now necessarily need to pull 10 experts and put them in the room. I've got an expert at my fingertips around certain things, and an expert who doesn't necessarily make mistakes if I know how to ask them the right questions.
Amanda, thank you. This has been one of those conversations that reminds you why this work matters, not just to organizations and regulators, but to every person whose data is being held, used, and trusted, to the people responsible for protecting it. We're so grateful that you have given us your time, your thinking, and your honesty today. To our listeners, thank you for being here. If this episode gave you something useful to take into your work, share it with someone who needs to hear it. You have been listening to Let's Talk Data, where Africa's most important conversations happen. Thank you. Thank you again for joining us. It's been insightful having you on the show. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, or share it with someone who's just as passionate about data as we are. Until next time, keep asking great questions, keep digging into the numbers, and as always, stay curious.